Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from David Lipofsky from the AODA. He'll be telling us about the push to create an education accessibility standard. So tell me a little bit about the recent push towards getting an accessibility education standard.
Well, we've actually been pushing for this for over half a decade. We need the government to agree to develop a new accessibility standard in Ontario under the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act to tackle the many accessibility barriers that still impede students with disabilities in our schools, our colleges, our universities, our other educational programming. There are over a third of a million students with special education needs in Ontario-funded schools. That's Catholic schools and public schools. A third of a million. It's one out of every six kids. And there are more students with disabilities who are either in our colleges or universities or would like to go. And an education is something you need to get a job. Right now, those barriers, there are recurring barriers in our school system, our colleges, our universities. There are physical barriers. Too many of the buildings aren't accessible. And the Toronto District School Board, our biggest school board in the country, there's 550 schools. And according to the Toronto District School Board, only 85 of them were accessible at the start of 2016, 85 out of 550. But students face other kinds of barriers, curriculum barriers, technology barriers, attitude barriers among staff and students. And I'm not saying nobody's doing anything good. There are lots of teachers who are trying to do the right thing and lots of universities and colleges trying to do the right thing. But the problem is twofold. The first is right now, every student and their family have to fight these barriers one at a time, one school at a time, or one college at a time. And educational organizations, whether it's school boards or colleges or universities, have to reinvent the wheel to fix these barriers one at a time. It's a formula for failure. And so we got a solution. The government of Ontario commendably passed the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act back in 2005 to make our province become fully accessible by 2025. The way it does that is by picking sectors of the economy and targeting them for accessibility by creating an accessibility standard that'll set out the rules, say what you got to fix, when you got to fix it. And they don't pull these out of the air. The way they develop them is they put together a committee called the Standards Development Committee with experts on what we need, people with disabilities, and experts on how to fix them. In this case, schools, teachers, professors, colleges, universities, get them around the table, figure out what the barriers are, figure out what the solutions are. That committee makes recommendations. The government looks at the recommendations and decides how much to put into the law. That's how it works. And to its credit, the government's made standards in areas like transportation, similar sectors. It's agreed to make one in healthcare, but they haven't agreed to do one in education. Now, they haven't said no, but they haven't said yes. So we are trying to get folks out there, people with disabilities, families of people with disabilities, friends of people with disabilities, everybody, to put the pressure on their local members of the legislature from all political parties, saying it's time to say yes. Now, commendably, the premier said in the Ontario legislature about a week and a half ago that she had met with me and with the accessibility minister, Tracy McCharles, and that they're looking into it. And I think that that's good, but we need them to go the next step and just say, yes, let's do it. We're nonpartisan. We're asking all parties to support this. The New Democrats have agreed to. The Liberals haven't said yes. The Progressive Conservatives haven't said, yes, they do it, but PC opposition member Bill Walker put the question to the premier in question period, like, why aren't you doing it? And that at least signals some level of support. We'd like Patrick Brown to say that if he's elected in 2018 and if we'd already have an education standard, he'd develop one. The last thing I want to tell you is that this is good for everyone because we are behind other places. There are other provinces in Canada and other places, especially in the U.S., that are ahead of us in tackling these problems. We got to play catch-up because if our kids with disabilities can't get a good education, they're not going to be able to get a good job. And that is a recurring big problem. Now, if people want to learn more about this, sign up for our updates by sending an email. And all you got to say in the email is, sign me up. And you send it to aodafeedback@gmail.com. I'm going to repeat that, aodafeedback@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, because we tweet a lot about this, and retweet our tweets, @AODA Alliance. We welcome anybody following us on Twitter and retweeting our tweets on this. And the most important thing people can do is call your member of the legislature. Tell them you want the government to agree to create an education accessibility standard so that a third of a million students with disabilities in our publicly funded schools, and even more that are in our colleges or universities or would like to be there, can get a good crack at a good education, which they need to get a good crack at a good job.
So, with an ideal standard being created, what would be included ideally?
Well, there's a number of areas that we need them to look at, but that's what a Standards Development Committee would look at. But for example, if they're building a new school or renovating an existing one, we should have standards on how the building should be done. We've got a building code, but it's not adequate. It's out of date. Even though they updated it, its accessibility provisions are inadequate. Not only are they inadequate, but they don't fit schools. You know, where they tell you to put grab bars in a bathroom is great for adults, but schools are for kids. The other examples, if you're a kid with autism, some of those kids benefit from having a service animal that helps them self-regulate and adjust to new environments. What if you want to bring them to school? Some school boards say yes, some say no, some don't have a policy. Every family's got to fight this battle over and over. Let's have one standard for the province, the same way we could have one standard for what an accessible school should look like. Another example, we're deploying digital technology in our classrooms and learning environments like never before. We don't have a standard for ensuring that that technology can be used by all kids, and that when the schools buy that stuff, they make sure that that's what they bought. And when we're spending money on digital technology, a lot of money, each school board shouldn't have to reinvent the digital accessibility wheel. Same with colleges and universities. It's way expanding in the learning environment. Those are just some examples. We got lots more.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for a continued push, what would you say?
I'd say right now, and we're nonpartisan, there are 2 years left before the next provincial election. We need the premier to say yes now so they get to work on developing an access standard. Otherwise, we get caught up and we have to wait till the next election and then we have to wait for that election to be over, and yet more students with disabilities will lose out in the meantime. 2025 is getting close. That's when we have to be fully accessible. We got to get to work now.
How close are we in terms of where we should be by the 2025 initiative?
We are well behind schedule, and we don't have a roadmap to get to there. So we're behind, and we're getting more behind.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. There may, in fact, be some good news in regards to the accessibility standard, at least in terms of how we rate it. I'd like to thank our own able-bodied observer, Samantha Newmarch, for sending me an article from Vice.com in regards to the Access Now app, which is basically a crowdsourcing tool that gathers information on accessibility features of various businesses in the Toronto area. This would have the advantage of telling a person with a disability where is a friendly spot and where might not be so much. This is something that should have been developed a long time ago, in my opinion. Fact is, a person with a disability has just as much right to make use of any business or service that might be available as anyone else. But having this new app to tell them where there might be greater accessibility, more features that are friendly and geared towards them, that'll really cut down on the trial and error process. In the past, Sam has talked about accessible housing. By bringing this app to my attention, she's taken it a step further. She's saying it's not just housing that has to be accessible. It should be buildings. Once again, thanks for the lead on that one. Now, a couple of words of congratulations to our friend, Kira Royal. She was on a week ago talking about her promises and her pledges to students with disabilities. She was elected third-year representative. It's my great pleasure to tell you folks, she made it. She's going to be able to follow through and just improve the standard for students at the University of Windsor with disabilities. The fact that she shared her own insights, her own experiences, means she's adding her voice to very real concerns. Lends a lot of legitimacy there. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Green Bean Cafe is Windsor's independent cafe specializing in fair trade, organic, and premium coffee products. Along with our delicious coffee, we serve other great food and drinks, like tea, fresh baked goods, sandwiches, and more. Visit us on the lower level of 2320 Wyandotte Street, across from the new engineering building. Get hours and more information at greenbeancoffee.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from David Lipofsky from the AODA, who was talking about the push for a greater accessibility standard for students with disabilities. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Pastor Riley McLaren. We'll be talking about mental health in the federal correction system and paying tribute to a member of the disabled community. So to begin, a while back, I had hoped to have you on during my series on mental health or self-image and disability. You deal a lot in the mental health field, working with corrections cases. So how do you see society perceiving these people coming out of the system?
Well, Cam, one of the challenges is when a crime has been committed, in conjunction with mental health needs, the focus becomes only the crime and not necessarily a number of the contributing factors. And it's not to say that people aren't responsible for their actions. They are. However, I think a healthy society is one that looks at all the different areas of that have contributed to crime, all the contributing factors. And when mental health needs go unaddressed, either on a medical level or people become social pariahs. That has a lot of consequences. When people aren't treated properly, if they're taken to the hospital only to get turned away by the emergency room, if there is ongoing symptoms and then it eventuates into a crime, we have to really start to ask the question, you know, what are the core issues here, and how are our communities responsible? We are stakeholders in our community, and if we don't care and love and find ways to serve people that struggle with mental health, things like poverty and crime and unemployment, the list could go on, are going to be affected.
So in the way of federal offenders, when they come in and they get out of the system struggling with a mental health issue, the fact that they are offenders can lead to this whole shaming issue. Any thoughts on this?
I think with federal offenders coming out, sometimes they've been treated, sometimes they haven't been. And we really, what do we have to work with? And we work with the local parole office and caseworkers and social workers, that sort of thing, to find, okay, how can we best serve somebody that is struggling with mental health? But the problem is when they're released from the federal institutions, we sometimes have very little information, or they don't have the proper medication that's with them. Sometimes they're released without medication, or they're not released with the right prescriptions. And that means we've got to get them into mental health services really quickly. And then when they get new doctors, then they're changing up the medication. They're not listening to them if they know what works for them, what doesn't work. Everything goes back to the drawing board. And unfortunately, with mental health and psychotropic drugs, you can't just change things. You know, there has to be a level of consistency. So there is a withdrawal process, and then there is a reacquainting or a readjusting to new medication that is very chaotic. And so I think your question was about shame. And when, no matter who they are, whether they're offenders or not, when people are denied services, you think that you can trust services that are supposed to provide mental health support when someone is in harm's way, and they don't, and you're left sort of, you're the only person in their lives that is willing to support them, it becomes very frustrating. And I can see how the offenders that I've worked with that struggle with mental health feel shamed, because even the system and the structures themselves won't sometimes support them. And I've seen this happen multiple times. I've brought guys to emergency, and they've been turned away. And, I think there's multiple reasons for that. One of them is stigma, that you think the medical community would be good at this. But I would say that the community as a whole is better at understanding mental health than medical health professionals. There is a dismissiveness in emergency rooms when it comes to people's suicidal ideation, when it comes to their needs, people loathe having to go to the hospital instead of going, okay, this is where I go to get help. And even as a caregiver, as a chaplain, I struggle with, bringing guys to the hospital, because I know it's the right thing to do, but sometimes they're going to get turned away, and I need to advocate for them to be able to get the help that they need so they can be safe.
So, on an unrelated note, recently you gave a speech honoring a member of the disability community who had passed on. Can you say a few words regarding this individual?
Mm-hmm. And is it okay to say his name?
Yes, should be.
So Terry has been a part of New Song Church for a number of years, and Terry was supported through Christian Horizons, and lived at a home with a number of other support workers who would help him live with other men in this home. And Terry had epilepsy, a severe form of epilepsy, and he needed to wear a bicycle helmet to protect himself for his own safety. And he recently had a seizure and had bleeding on the brain and didn't survive.
So how is it that this individual affected you personally?
Well, Terry was a special guy. He was very calm. He had a presence about him that was very special. He had a very kind smile. He would come to church with Christian Horizons workers. And, you know, as a speaker, I'd be speaking, and lots of different things are going on in a community while I'm speaking. And if it was ever a little chaotic or I was feeling uncomfortable, I'd always look over at Terry, and Terry would just calm me right down. He is a gift to us, and he is missed. And at his funeral, so many people were there for this guy that in, you know, the world's eyes, and have seen as someone that couldn't contribute to society, but the truth is that he contributed more than so many other people that I've known in my life by just being him.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. What it all comes down to, folks, is simply the quality of life for those affected. Whether it be a push for an education standard, or even a better housing standard, or just the idea that people affected by mental health are entitled to the same rights and the same protections as us. It may look like a series of statistics. This person has that right on paper, but we're not actually going to enforce it. But in reality, what this is really about is people. People with jobs, hopes, dreams, families, loved ones, people with the potential to create and to move forward. And especially in relation to the AODA's work, and to some degree even Riley's, it's about creating for the future. People who can become leaders, even if they've spent most of their lives in the corrections system, they may come out and they may decide they want to be a positive influence on the community. How is this going to happen if we, the people, decide simply to look away because we're not especially comfortable with how they're affected or what they did? It's not our place to be their judge or jury. For those coming out of the correction system, they've done their time. They've earned a second chance. And if they have mental health, treat them just like anyone else in society. For young people in the education system, it's a matter of respecting and recognizing their rights. It's fine to say, yeah, we're going to create an accessible school for you, but unless we follow through on these policies, unless we really take it to heart, it's just words on paper. Now, when Sam mentioned about this app to determine what's accessible and what isn't, that struck me as a great innovation. Fact is, there should be more services like that. Not just to determine what is accessible, but also how things can be made accessible, which is something that should be taken to heart by everyone involved in the engineering of modern buildings and just any sort of construction detail. The possibility will always be there that a person with a disability will want to make use of this service. By cutting off access, we're cutting off their rights. And it's not our place to do that simply because a person might move a little differently, think a little differently, speak a little differently. Who are we to say, you have no right to access this service or this facility? Are we really going to slide that far back in our way of thinking? Life is about pushing forward. It's about the next leap forward. It's about taking the next risk, seeing who can benefit from our work today, planning for tomorrow. And the push must always carry on. True equality isn't just handed to you. No group that's been marginalized in history has simply had equality handed to them. It's not how it works. Everyone must recognize that their fellow human beings have something to contribute, have something worthwhile to say, and work with them. Nothing about us without us. So goes the saying. I love that. Came as a welcome reminder a few weeks ago. It's very true. You can't have people speaking to the needs of people with disabilities without including them in these discussions and these insights. It takes a person with a disability to know what they need. Doesn't mean they're going to know what every one of their brothers and sisters out there needs, but it does mean they can speak with some measure of insight into accessibility. It's only through spending time with someone with a disability that you come to realize that they are, in fact, an equal, worthwhile, intelligent human being, no matter what the condition. And this app really, really spoke to me, in so much as this person, sure, they could go through sifting the data, find out what's accessible for themselves. Yeah, that's great. But does it actually make a difference for all those out there who might not be as technologically adept or who might not know how to find this? No, it wouldn't. But making it something accessible, something readily usable, that's a gift. And for the AODA's work forward, they should keep pushing. They should never, ever give up. If there are politicians who disagree with their politics, their point of view, who say, we don't have the budget for it, or we don't have the manpower, find the manpower, find the budgeting. Should have thought of that long ago. These are not statistics on paper. These are people. People who can and should be allowed to contribute to the future. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, and the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. But as I was saying about leaders and creating for the future, it's another reason I'm very proud of Kira Royal for her recent victory at the U, being able to actually speak to these matters, to talk to people with disabilities and create something for them. But the key, my friends, is always understanding. The key is finding out what the real needs are and how to work with them. You can't speculate. You can't assume I know everything there is to know. And you also can't assume it's one size fits all. Talk to people. Understand. It'll help not only build a bridge of communication, but it'll make you a more well-rounded person for the fact that you'll know that humanity is, in fact, very diverse. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.